You're listening to the Tom and Curley Show. Tom Tangney here. John Curley has been here all morning, just had to step away for this final hour of the Tom and Curley Show on this happy Friday. But that's okay, because the short straw guy is back.
Round, round, get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round, I get around.
Hello, Tom.
That's right. Mike Lewis in the flesh. And I have to ask you, where have you been?
So, this is kind of a weird thing to bring up on air.
Okay.
It had been, I think, I don't know how long it's been, like 3 weeks since I did the show with John was the last time.
That's right.
We wrap up the show, and I'm feeling a little bit off, like a little odd. And so I go to Bartell's. Maybe I need some cold medicine. I buy what I'm buying. I look at the receipt. The receipt has that pre-programmed thank you on it, right? And I thought,
sure.
That makes me feel kind of nice. I'm like, that's really great. And later in the day, I'm listening to, I think, both Sean Hannity and then later Joe Scarborough. And I'm like, these guys are making such terrific points, both of them. And I go to the doctor because I'm still feeling really off. And the doctor tells me that I have actually badly sprained my anterior BS detector. And what had happened was I was in the studio with John. He said it was overexposure to John. And so he said, you've got to step out of the studio for a period of time.
I see.
And get yourself back in sort of a lower BS environment. And so he said I could come in for an hour at a time.
I see.
On the show with you to build, work my way back up.
Yes.
I mean, this is not one of those things you want to bring up. I'm a 52-year-old guy. You assume your BS detector is always going to work. And then you have that day where it doesn't.
By the way, I have concocted a perfect antidote for John. That's how I've been able to carry on. Maybe I'll sell you some.
Obviously. Obviously, you are much more of a hero than I realized.
I'm under the table. Very good. Well, I'm glad I asked. Who knew? So, now that you I guess your BS detector is what? In fine fashion or just
it's ramping up? I'd say it's
okay.
Mid-range right now.
Well, I think this would be the next story we're going to talk about actually is a good one to apply that BS detector to, by the way. And it involves a police officer. Now, I know that John keeps talking about the blue light in his heart and the blue light somewhere else. I forget. But the idea is that he tends to take the side of the cops and then having to play counter to John, always say, well, could they have done something better? This is a case where I am hard-pressed to think what the police officers could have done better, and yet it is a controversy. Now, here's the story. This is a guy named Officer Nick Guzley is one of a series of police officers who were following a guy who was inside the REI, and according to store employees, he stole an ice axe. Now, an ice axe, if you know, it's not a huge, it's just a little, you know, like, you know, your wrist motion can use it. It's a relatively small or tiny axe, but it's an ice axe. And he is in the store, and he's kind of waving it around like, nobody come near me as I call. This is a piece of body cam footage that obviously we can't see, but also here, this is still inside the REI when the officer calling for backup, the man with the axe refusing to follow instructions. Oh, and it's not playing. Why is that? Okay, now let's try this.
So he's been swinging, he's looking back at me, and he's holding it up like this, like he's going to swing it at me. Drop it now. Man, it's okay, just drop the ice axe.
Okay, he does not drop the ice axe. And now for blocks following, police officers follow this man through the streets of downtown Seattle, in effect. I mean, he's not quite centered downtown, but up in South Lake Union, heading, I think, toward downtown. And they're continuing to follow him. They're asking him to drop it. He refuses. He's not swinging it wildly. He's just walking it down somewhat threateningly, walking down the streets. At this point, now this officer, Nick Guzley, pulls up in a patrol car and kind of like joins at the head of this this parade through the streets of Seattle. He ends up getting closer to him. And now here is the moment when he actually then, this Officer Nick Guzley, takes down the man with the ice axe with a bear hug tackle.
Get on the ground! Drop it! Drop the axe!
Okay. The guy now has been convicted of stealing. He's now in a prison and all of this. So we're setting aside the law and order aspect of the case has already been adjudicated. But right now, the police officer is being, I guess we can't say, he's facing discipline or possible disciplinary charges for his failure to de-escalate the situation. Now, again, like officers often point out to me, Tom, you haven't been on the streets. You don't know for nothing. But based on the body camera images that we've seen on the police officers, this to me seems like ideal police work. What say you, Mike Lewis?
There's a couple of odd things about this one. One, it was his supervisor who turned him into the police.
That's right.
Which,
yeah,
which is really shocking, and it almost makes me feel like there was some brewing issue between the two of them prior to
This particular officer, perhaps.
Right. I mean, that's the only way you can anticipate, because I agree fundamentally. You look at the entire run of the video, not just like the little clips we did here, but the entire run, they are in de-escalation mode from the very beginning. Mm. They're asking him, they're saying, hey, it's all right, man. You know, they are not escalating the situation. And this went on for blocks.
Yes.
Before they finally decided to tackle a guy who could have, had there been somebody walking the other direction on the sidewalk, taken a swing. And as a person who went through the Washington Alpine Club alpine training and has done some mountaineering, you know, an ice axe can do a fair bit of damage if you swing it and connect with somebody,
sure,
especially in the
absolutely
head. Absolutely. People hurt themselves with ice axes all the time who know how to use ice axes.
Okay, yeah.
So this is absolutely a weapon and absolutely something that you can't have somebody who's off running around with or walking around a neighborhood with. I'm rarely perplexed by these situations. You see the body cam and maybe you realize that all the information isn't there.
Yeah.
There is nothing that indicates that this actually wasn't a first de-escalation effort. And secondarily, it was a tackle. It wasn't like they pulled a gun. They didn't even tase the guy.
Yeah.
So I am completely, the only thing I can figure out is why would his supervisor not like give him an accolade for this?
Yeah. Okay. So the one thing I was wondering if, do they feel like, again, I think we're grasping for straws here because I agree. Both of us seem to be on the same page with this. Was there a danger in allowing him to walk as many blocks as he did with an ice axe where he could have lashed out to passersby? Because what we didn't have time to play is, hey, you know, stay away. They're trying to get people that might have been on the sidewalks to stay away. Was there a way to de-escalate it at the same time as they prevented him from, you know, from moving through the streets?
No.
But even if there was, that's not apparently, again, and this is according to the story, that was not a failure to de-escalate. That might have been a failure of, you know, stopping him at an earlier stage. But okay, so we're basically in agreement.
There's completely
no discussion here. We'll have to find out. And again, he's facing disciplinary measures. The issue has been raised. It hasn't been adjudicated by the police department
yet. The police officers union essentially made the same point we did. Like, this is a guy who should be commended, not a guy who should be in any way reprimanded.
Absolutely. Yeah, without pulling a gun and no harm was done
absolutely
to the guy he tackled or to the officer.
They didn't hold him down. They didn't beat him.
Okay.
They didn't, you know, they tackled the guy and took an ice axe away.
That's right.
That
okay
he had stolen.
Yeah, that's perfect. Okay. We're in agreement on this. And I'm not sure we're going to disagree on this next story much, too, but
I'll do what I can.
Here, we're going to play a highlight that you'll recognize immediately. I don't have to tell you who the highlight is of, but we can't get enough of this one particular 26-second highlight.
Dan Wilson wants a fastball away. Ground ball, base hit in the right field. Heading for third is Terrence Long. The throw by Ichiro. Beautiful. Peggy got him. Holy smoke. A laser beam strike from Ichiro to the third baseman, David Bell. And Terrence Long is gunned down at third base. What a throw. Two outs.
No, that didn't just happen this past week. That was
Dan Wilson came back to catch.
Yes, that's the classic Ichiro. That was sort of like welcome to Seattle Ichiro, or you know, Ichiro really strutting his stuff early on in his long stead here. And then yesterday we got this surprising news. This is Mariners manager Scott Service on Ichiro's continuing role with the team, which apparently is not going to be on the field.
He is going to be with us every day, and you'll see Ichiro still working out, running around, shaking around a few fly balls, taking BP. He's going to transition in this other role, which I think is great. He'll be a resource for myself, the coaching staff, but more importantly, our players. There's always things that players want to discuss with players. And I think with Ichiro's experience in so many different areas, he's played all over the world. There's a lot to offer to our ball club. So he'll be around. I'm excited to have him around and looking forward, to the future with him.
And then one more question was thrown the manager's way. Was this like the reason you brought him back, basically to move him into administration up to management? This is GM Jerry DePoto.
something that we have talked about. They're one of the alternatives we have talked about dating back to when we signed Ichi. So, you know, this is who we always had in mind, potential outcomes when and if the time came that he was no longer going to play actively on our roster. So the answer to that question is we've been thinking about this for a couple of months, so to speak. And only when Ben Gamel returned did it become, or when it was apparent to us that Ben was coming back sooner than expected, did it become a necessity to move the speed of the transaction up.
Okay, so now it's our chance to talk Ichiro. I don't know how huge an Ichiro fan is. I mean, to me, he was my favorite player after Ken Griffey to ever don a Mariners outfit. And I am disappointed to hear this news. I know that he's not working or providing the necessary help, perhaps, on the team. But still, for old time's sake, being an old time guy like myself, next time I would go to the ballpark, I'd like to see Ichiro, even if he was just sitting on the bench. So this disappoints me, but it clearly makes sense in terms of baseball. Where do you sit on this?
Yeah, this is one of, I don't know, the job that they outlined it to him, which sounded rather tepid.
You're right. You know? Yes,
it's kind of in the baseball equivalent of a casino greeter, you know. And it really is. I mean, this is not, he's never been a guy who's offered a lot of advice to other players.
I know.
I mean, like, all of the stuff they're saying sounds great if you are one of those guys who sort of was chummy with other people and offered, like, he was always a bit austere. They liked joking with him. It wasn't like he wasn't a well-liked teammate.
Right.
But all of the things they described are essentially none of the things he has done in his career. And so I don't know why he's going to necessarily start now. I mean, this is, for them, it's just a big, face-saving gesture, but the fact is they brought him in when they needed him. They didn't have somebody better for the same money who they could get. They knew it would be a good boost on the season. If he is a positive influence somehow in the clubhouse, great. But he didn't look like he had it much, you know, when he played. And that was the more disappointing thing, is you kind of hope a guy like that, you know, would maybe eke out, because he at 42, he was still playing really well, right? So it's a disappointing, because I really dig the guy.
Yeah.
But their description of, like, I don't even know if I would have done this, you know, this sort of job, you know.
And his agent says, hey, we're not calling this a retirement. They are not putting out the embers there of saying he might be back in a uniform. You never know.
They could have injuries and they could use him
again.
That's
right,
and I think that's mainly what they're doing, is that's why he's going to be out there. You don't have a whole lot of, like, sort of team advisors taking batting practices, shagging fly balls.
Yeah.
So my guess is that they're trying to keep him and allowing him to stay in shape should the need arise.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. So I hope he's happy. My hunch is he isn't.
No.
I mean, remember, he's 44 years old. He wants to play till he's at least 50.
He's going to end up in the sort of Ricky Henderson category of, like, the International League somewhere, you know, still hanging on, maybe. Or maybe he's just going to walk away. I don't know.
We'll have to see. Okay. So, again, we don't disagree on that one. How about this one? We have an initiative. It's called 1634. And it's, again, they're just gathering signatures. So this is nowhere near getting to the ballot yet. But this is a proposed statewide initiative to bar cities and counties from imposing their own taxes on sweetened beverages. Gee, I wonder who they're going after, as well as other food and drinks typically sold in supermarkets. This is an initiative sponsored by the American Beverage Association, is pushing the measure and helping pay for it, providing $25,000 from Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Dr. Pepper, Snapple Group, and Red Bull North America. They have a grocery store owner who says, this really impacts my business, having this sugar tax. This is an effort on the level of the state to try to prevent Seattle from doing what Seattle is doing independent of the state. How do you feel about this kind of approach? Do you think this is a legitimate effort at fighting Seattle by going outside Seattle to restrict Seattle? Or do you think this is it's sort of unfair picking on the biggest city in the state?
Well, I am not I'm a fan of cities being allowed to do, you know, within a framework, whatever dumb legislation they want to do.
Okay.
You know, they have every opportunity to, or smart.
Yeah, right.
I mean, but I kind of like the idea of giving them a measure of local control. If Seattle wants to compare favorably or disfavorably based on a sugar tax to a city adjacent, you know, to, let's just say to Bellevue or to Renton or something like that, I think that should be in Seattle's purview and as it should be in Bellevue or Renton. So I don't like any, like, no one can do this form of legislation unless you're dealing with sort of criminal or civil, like serious civil things, not anything like a sugar tax. However, I've never been a fan of the sugar tax.
Okay.
I am a big fan of giving people information on, I don't drink sodas at all, ever. I never have my entire life. Okay. So it's never been an issue for me, but I do believe that those people who say that you should treat sugar as a controlled substance, from a health standpoint, they have a point. And actually, in Mexico City, where they did ban sugary drinks or heavily tax them rather than ban them, they have seen a decline in diabetes.
Yes.
I mean, it's a correlated decline. It's not like this; they're not related. And so there is something there, but I still believe that cities should be able to regulate its own. If 7-Eleven wants to sell, you know, Mountain Dew Ultra, you know, I don't have a problem with it. But I would like a little bit better. You know, I loved it when for fast foods they required them to print calorie count and fat count.
You did. Okay.
I loved that because that's information. Then you can make your own decision on whether or not you want, you know, whatever chalupa.
Yeah.
Right.
So what's interesting right now is that we're seeing a lot of this, that the state of Washington, it's a blue state. I mean, it leans Democratic. That hasn't been much of a problem for the governorship. I guess it's been in Democratic hands for 30 plus years. But the state is not all blue. I mean, there is a strong red or Republican component to this. And what I've noticed is there are a lot of rules that the Seattle is chafing at. For instance, they want to be able to do rent control within the city confines, but it's not allowed by state law, and they're trying to challenge that. Here's an example of the city getting ahead of the state in terms of what they are forbidden from doing, and the state now, or at least an initiative, trying to say, wait a minute, we need to corral the city of Seattle. The one thing I'll give credit to these initiative backers for doing is they're not trying to do away with the sugar tax in Seattle.
Right.
What they're doing is saying, okay, great, you got there first. We respect that. You just can't increase it. Oh, you know, we're putting a restriction on from here on in, you can't do any more. And I think what they want to do, and again, the fact that there are these big beverage associations that are pouring money into this and fighting it, what they want to do is they want to, like, stanch the flow. They want to make sure that this doesn't spread, because if it happens in Seattle, then it could happen in Bellevue or Kent or wherever. And so they want to kind of stop it. I don't know if they'll get enough signatures. You're a very insightful political guy. Do you think this will make it on the ballot or not?
If you've got it, the threshold is relatively low in Washington State. If you've got enough money and this group has enough money, you can get anything on the ballot. You know, as they say, you're going to get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich.
Yes.
Like, getting on the ballot in Washington State is not that difficult if you've got the money to do it.
Wow, that's interesting, because there have been a number of initiatives that have fallen short of late that we expected to have.
Not with this level of
more
money
support. But yeah, no, I see. It's the key is not the popularity. The key is the money behind it.
Exactly.
And God knows Coca-Cola has plenty of money if they need to spend it. Okay, that's great. We are coming up to the final half hour of the Tom and Curly Show. And we are going to, I love this topic that Andrew, our producer, has come up with. Can you overdose on happiness? That's a topic that you and I are going to wrestle with. And before we get started in about 5 minutes, do you feel like you're a happy guy or a not happy guy? Where are you on the happiness quotient between 1 and 10?
I would say I vacillate.
You vacillate
widely.
Okay. Oh, that's good. That'll make for an interesting discussion. And that's coming up next on the Tom and Curly Show. Welcome back to the final half hour of the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curly away just for this hour. He'll be back bright and bushy on Monday morning, and filling in for him, the long-lost Mike Lewis.
Happy to be back.
He's returning with a low battery-operating BS detector.
Better every moment.
Okay, perfect.
You're feeding it nicely.
So this next topic, I love these kinds of... they're like philosophical topics about what it means to be human, which that may sound a little too highfalutin, but there's this a great article in something called the Nautilus issue called asking the question, can you overdose on happiness? And it takes the example of this particular individual, 33-year-old, he happens to be a German guy, I don't know if that matters, but he had been suffering from severe obsessive compulsive disorder and generalized anxiety syndrome, and he had implanted electrodes in a central part of his reward system. I mean, not he did, but I mean his doctors did. And he has something called a stimulator battery that deep stimulates his deep brain to keep the anxiety low and the happiness quotient higher than it normally would. And they're at this point now where they had to replace his stimulator battery. And they sort of decided, you know what, we'd like to kind of. They say they want to optimize its parameters, this battery. So they're going to do a few tests on him. And so they said, okay, we're going to test how strong the voltage should be for your system that's these electrodes implanted. And they hit the volt at 1. And he says, okay, don't feel anything. They hit it at 2. Not that much. Nothing's really changed. They got to 3, and he says, okay, I'm starting to feel a little happier. My anxiety is dropping. And then they went to 4. And at 4 volts, he says he had this feeling of happiness that, you know, just this idea that, wow, I think we've hit the sweet spot. And they said, okay, good. That's the level we want. Now we're going to put it up to 5 and see how you respond. And he says, whoa, this is great, but this might be a little too much. You know, that he says he had this fantastic feeling, but he thought it was a bit too much. And they could register that it was so almost unnerving how happy he felt that his anxiety level kind of rose. He's okay. And so they agreed, he and the scientists that were doing this, agreed that they should put it at a slightly lower dose. And then the next day, as he was leaving the hospital or whenever he was ready to go, he said, hey, doc, I kind of like to re-experience that feeling. And this now raises this great issue about how happy do we have a right to be? How happy should doctors allow us to be? Is happiness the goal of health? And all sorts of great issues that I now throw in your lap, Mike Lewis.
So you've seen the movie Sleeper, right?
Yeah. The orgasmatron.
Right.
Yes.
That's what it made me think of almost immediately.
Sure, yeah.
When I saw it. This is how much happiness, right? I mean, We were joking earlier about, you know, if you were the rat in the lab, and, you know, the as we always like to call it, the cocaine rat, hitting the lever, you know, and going for more doses instead of even going for food.
Yes.
Which they found, you know, will certain drugs will inspire that kind of behavior. Would you do it in this case? And I think it would be awful. To have something that could make you happy sort of almost on demand and constantly. I think that there would have to be a tremendous number of unintended effects of something like that. And they even say, like, most studies will say that if you spend your time doing nothing but pursuing your own happiness, it has exactly the opposite effect.
Okay.
And so, but we also know that happiness is not just this sort of vague, ephemeral emotional thing. It's a chemical reaction. I mean, you know, your happiness, it's a feedback loop between sort of this thought process as well as the actual neurons and the actual chemical signals that you're getting. And so can you dial some of that up to keep yourself from those deeper troughs? Because some of those deeper troughs, people who are depressed don't ever climb out of.
That's right.
And so can you do that? And I think on that end, if you can sort of like narrow the bandwidth of up and down, that makes a little more sense than being able to just like dial it all the way to 11 to make yourself that happy.
Well, what's interesting, so they quote this one neurologist says, it's not my job, as a neurologist at least, to make people happy. So what she's saying in these kinds of experiments, what her job is to take it from -5 up to 0. So if you are, say, depressed, and you are severely depressed, and you need some kind of electrical stimulation to your deep brain to make you not depressed, then she feels like there she's doing health. That's a health benefit. To make you happy, she says, is something altogether in another realm that she doesn't feel like belongs to the doctor. At the same time, you now have doctors that can make you feel the way you want to feel, and they are now withholding that information or that ability because they decide it's not good for you. And then the question is, who are you to decide what I want?
Right.
And they say, well, maybe the Hippocratic Oath. I don't know. But that's the kind of dilemma of as a patient, how comfortable do you feel with doctors dictating to you how you should feel as opposed to you dictating to the doctors how you want to feel?
Well, this has always been the question in pain management, much less anything else. I mean, this is we're talking about this conversation is about, you know, elective surgery in some ways. It can happen there as well. I mean, it's always going to be a tension between doctors deciding what's practical from their from their, you know, ethical and medical standards, and what's practical from you and your own desire to be a better person,
right,
a better human,
yeah,
being, or an enhanced human being. You know, I don't think there is an easy answer to that, but I do think that when you get where you should create the intersection, when you sort of start worrying about, you know, jumping over the fence, is when you are pursuing something that is not, you know, that is not necessary to continue functioning in society. I mean, like when they're talking about, that's sort of the point I was making earlier. Like if you're in really debilitating depression, and you cannot, you know, hold a job, you cannot hold a relationship, you cannot do the things you need to do, does it make more sense to medically intervene in something like that? It may in some cases.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's not just going to be like, you know, showing somebody a comedy is not going to get them out of that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you could crank up this to an elated level, which,
yeah,
is what, you know, some drugs do.
Well, exactly. You're, heroin.
Well, heroin, yeah, you know, Molly, there's any, yeah, number, sure, of drugs that do that sort of thing. They're finding that over time, it's not just a chemical dependency. You start remapping your actual receptors in your head. And,
yeah,
then, so what do you do then?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you increase the stimulus to the point where you're going to maintain that and not just have a different sort of dysfunction?
Now, so in general, I think I tend to present myself at least as a really relatively happy guy compared to the next guy. I just feel like I always feel like I'm up. I always feel like I'm happy. I always feel that, and I realize
you
that
give that impression,
and I realize that other people don't, and sometimes people that don't sneer at people like me and think, what kind of, you know, la la land does he live in? But one of the things that I thought, and I said, well, I'm happy in my la la land.
I think it's
land,
because
don't
you don't
mind.
Drive, actually.
Yeah,
I think because you don't drive in Seattle, you've given yourself a much better chance at being happy generally.
But one of the things that I thought was interesting about one of the neuropsychologists that we're talking about said, you know, what's important is to not feel the same way all the time. Their argument is it's better for your health to have sways.
Absolutely.
Ups and downs. That's what I was asking right before the break. You know, do you feel yourself like you're an up person? You have swings.
Absolutely.
But there are mood swings, and they argue within reason that those mood swings are actually a positive.
And sometimes, you know, even if you're not giving the impression of being happy, you can be pretty happy inside.
Sure,
but,
yeah.
But your outward appearance may, yeah, not be. People are like, wow, he's not happy. Like, no,
yeah.
No.
That's right. Well, that's what we think of you. Happy.
Yeah, I know.
we realize that you internally are much happier.
I'm happier inside than I am on the outside.
You got to work on that. I wonder, you know, if there can be a reverse version. Maybe if you're too up, like maybe I am, that I should take something to depress me a little, to give me a little more sway of my emotions.
You need to be a little more serious around here, Tom, no matter how you're feeling inside.
I'll never survive.
Behave like the rest of us.
Okay, so coming up now, we've got the best part. Hey, Mike, this is great. You didn't have to work all week. You didn't have to slog through 5 days of this to get to the sweet spot of the Atomic Girlie Show. You get the best of the best in the last 15 minutes of Friday's show. We hear from our listeners. Can't wait to see what you guys got to say.
Coming up.
Back to the final segment of the Friday show of Tom and Curly. Tom Tangney here. John Curly away for this past hour. He will be back bright and early come Monday morning. And we've got the great Mike Lewis filling in. But before we get to anything else, we have to watch for the mailman over the hill.
I'm the mailman. As you can see, I'm the mailman. Don't nobody mess with me. I'm the mailman. If you didn't know, I'm the mailman. I bring the mail to your door.
Here he comes. He's bearing fruit. And before we get started, let's hear from the little lady in the pickle jar just to make sure. Yes, everything is on tap. So, Mike Lewis, what do you see? What do you like in our bag of letters?
All right, from the first letter under the heading, I have no idea. From Jack Quackenbush, MD. Phil McCracken's recollection of his visit to my office varies somewhat from mine. He came to my office complaining that the top of his bald head was snow white. Quickly diagnosing his malady, I whipped up a concoction, directed him to drink it. He complied immediately and blurted out, "Oh my God, this tastes like S." I replied, "It was. You were a quart low."
That is that's some inside joke that even the insiders, I don't think, get. Okay,
Extremely inside.
Moving on to the head tax and John's economic theory, Bob and Index. So, if a guy who makes less than the taco vendor buys a taco, is that trickle up? John's version of trickle down does not work. Reagan proved it.
From Sean in Arlington, it just occurred to me that the best defense of trickle-down economics appears to be what is best described as trickle-down logic. Meanwhile, back at the ranch to this day, there's been no intelligent argument against the promise and inevitability of basic income.
Sean has banging that drum. And Mark in SeaTac, cities all over the country offer tax credits to lure companies that will hire people. Seattle wants to charge companies $500 for every hire? That is just weird.
And from Nicholas in Seattle, John, you rightly claim that an Amazon executive who makes $210,000 creates as many as 7 jobs. Following that same logic, we can expand your stance on trickle-down economics to include the pay of the working class. A person making $60,000 a year would create 2 jobs, utilizing the ratio you used for an Amazon executive.
Hear, hear. And a 425, when you increase wages for the average worker, it increases economic activity and creates wealth, just as if you had lowered taxes on the highest earners. However, if you lower taxes on the highest earners, there is no guarantee those savings will be used to support more jobs. Tax savings or increased earnings that reward the working class are almost always spent in ways that create jobs. The working class outnumbers the highest earners, and together they create more jobs than the 1% ever could. Boy, a lot of people really, head tax head on.
So, switching topics, is the Democratic Party too inclusive? From 425, the Democratic Party has had a cancer growing within itself for a long time. You are starting to see it show its ugly face under the banner of postmodernism, cultural Marxism, and intersectional feminism, with Antifa as a strong arm whose violence is conveniently ignored by Democratic politicians and media. I think Jason Rantz must have written in for this one.
Well, Jordan Peterson has that one follower. 206, when the Democratic Socialists are voted into various positions, like the former mayor of Milwaukee, they are voted back in for record numbers of terms.
To wait in line or to not, even when you've ordered ahead, from Dell in Linwood. It's hilarious that people will stand in line for food they've pre-ordered on an app, but will then cut in the ferry line without hesitation.
I wonder if those are the same people. That's good. And 206, usually when you make a mobile phone order ahead at Starbucks of time, there is a special counter set aside to pick up your order. It is away from the usual line on purpose. Every store that has order ahead should do this. Yeah, I don't know if you heard that story that people still get in line even when they've pre-ordered.
And in celebration of boating season, from 425, John, you should give your sailboat to the winner of the know-it-all quiz.
At
some point, like everyone who owns a sailboat, John will be giving it away to somebody.
Yes. Well, I don't know if you heard that too, but yeah, it's been sitting on the side of his house. He hasn't taken it out once.
Right.
And he figures he'll sell it for $50. Oh, speaking of which, 360, Curly, since you aren't using that sailboat, I'll take it off your hands for $50. You don't even have to put it on Craigslist.
From Darren in Fall City, time to get my Bodie McBoatface in the cut. Woohoo!
And Heidi in Redondo, hey, John, when you go out on opening day, make sure you don't sit near the head. It really stinks.
And to cheerlead or not to cheerlead, from Jim in Elma, cheerleaders at football games are there to distract you from your team's crappy play. I liked Bill the Beeman at Kingdome leading the wave better.
A Bill the Beerman.
Beerman.
You know, I used to pour beer for Bill the Beerman.
Really?
Yes, when I worked at the Kingdome. And our letter of the day comes from Chrissy in Port Townsend. Listening to you two talk about whether or not the NFL should have cheerleaders is hilarious. I rarely agree with Curly, but I am a big fan of the cheerleaders. And just for the record, I'm a middle-aged woman with a husband and 2 kids. In my opinion, they don't show the cheerleaders enough on TV. I would much rather see them dance when we score a touchdown than see the player do a stupid dance. The cheerleaders work hard, barely get paid, don't get much respect, and don't get much TV time. I, for one, do not want to see them go. My feminist friends think I'm crazy, but I say a woman should do whatever she wants to do. It's a choice, just as the players know the risks of football. Maybe it's the Greek in me, but I love the gladiator aspect of the sport and also don't want to see football get soft. Go Hawks and Seagulls! Seagals. Thank you, Chrissy in Port Townsend. Where do you stand on the professional cheerleaders?
I could do without them.
Okay. Oh, we're starting to form a consensus here at Cairo Radio. But we love the Sea Gals nonetheless.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
Out of time. Bye-bye.